Thanks very much, David, and thank you very much to the University of Melbourne for this invitation. It is great to be back at one of my alma maters to deliver this Freeban lecture in public policy. John Freeban's extensive publication record and long history of contributions to public debate speak to his abiding interest in public policy across a broad range of areas. And so it is indeed an honour to be invited to speak as part of a lecture series named for him. My lecture tonight is motivated from the point of view of someone tasked with advising on the setting of monetary policy. In doing so, we should occasionally step back and consider how we think about what we're trying to achieve. It has long been known that the effects of monetary policy occur with a lag. Less appreciated is that some of the crucial concepts in our analysis are in some sense invisible and therefore not directly observable. So it can be a question of how we can even know if monetary policy is achieving its goals. So that is the focus of my talk tonight, and I recognise it was a bit of a mystery before I mentioned that. The objectives of the monetary policy are given in the Reserve Bank Act 1959 and further elaborated in the Statement on the Conduct of Monetary Policy. We have an inflation target. The board is seeking to set monetary policy so that inflation averages between 2 and 3% over the medium term. We're also charged with pursuing full employment and contributing to the economic prosperity and welfare of the Australian people. Taking the inflation target first, to know what to do, we need to know what drives inflation and how monetary policy can influence those drivers. This is an issue of causal relations. There are many factors influencing pricing decisions of firms and other participants in the economy. A core influence, however, is surely the balance of supply and demand, or, in other words, the amount of spare capacity. When demand is strong and begins to outstrip supply, firms tend to raise their prices. Taking this micro-level behavioural response up to the macro, economy-wide level, economists have often represented this dynamic as a relationship between inflation and unemployment. Now, at first, this graph looks like a random scatter of points with no real structure. Things do become a bit clearer when we connect the dots through time. There are a few short periods where inflation increases temporarily, even though I have used an inflation series that excludes so-called volatile items, namely petrol, fruit, and vegetables. Abstracting from those brief periods, though, we see two distinct downsloping relationships, one with high inflation in the late 1980s and one with much lower inflation that continues to the present day. These two distinct phases are connected by a period where both unemployment and inflation declined. Observations of this shifting relationship, both here and abroad, spurred the economics profession to recast how they thought about it. The seminal intervention on this was Milton Friedman's presidential address to the American Economics Association in 1968. Friedman argued that it was not so much a relationship between unemployment and inflation themselves. Rather, the connection concerned the gap between actual unemployment and a notion of full employment on the one side, and unexpectedly low or high inflation on the other. Inflation was high in the 1980s and lower more recently, even with lower unemployment, because that's what people expected. And if you wanted to lower unemployment, Friedman argued, there was a limit to how far you could go without creating surprise inflation. To keep unemployment below that limit, you would end up creating ever higher inflation as people were no longer surprised by its new higher rate. The rate of unemployment consistent with full employment was the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, or the unlovely acronym, the NIRU. According to this reasoning of Friedman's, the relationship between unemployment and inflation was therefore an expectations-augmented Phillips curve, and it looked something like this. Actual inflation minus expected inflation is some function of unemployment minus the NIRU. There was just one problem. There were things on both sides of this equation that you cannot directly observe. Neither expected nor inflation nor the Nauru can be directly measured. And if this is really how we think the world works, it means that we're making monetary policy on the basis of things that are invisible. In grappling with this issue, I've found it helpful to characterise economic concepts and quantities according to how visible they are, whether they can be directly observed, indirectly inferred, or neither. Now, the easiest quantities to deal with are those that are directly observable. The price of the coffee that many of you bought this morning was observable. So was your volume, was its volume, if you had been inclined to measure that. There are many such quantities in economic life, including the current exchange rate between the Australian and US dollars, the most recent transacted price on an asset, such as a particular house, the legal minimum wage, the interest rate charged on a particular loan, or my bank balance. A somewhat less straightforward set of concepts that are those that aren't quite directly observable, but are measurable, perhaps with some effort. Often these are collective measures of related individual quantities that are not completely homogeneous. They include things like the unemployment rate or inflation, individual employment statuses and individual prices can be directly observed. But you have to make choices about how you combine individual states into an economy-wide statistic. Harder still are the things that are unobservable but are inferable because they can be detected indirectly. This might be because of the effect they have on something that is more easily observed. And a good example here, and one that I will use throughout this lecture, is the Nauru, the rate of unemployment below which wages growth starts to pick up. You can't observe it directly, but you can guess that you're below it if wages growth starts accelerating. Another kind of inferable is the subjective view someone has about an observable or measurable quantity. Expectations and forecasts fall into this category. You can't directly observe the expectation inside somebody's head, but you can ask about it. And it's because it's a belief about something more concrete, people should be able to elicit those beliefs. So the two unobservable things in our Phillips curve are, at least in principle, inferable. But they aren't directly measurable, and it is reasonable to expect that they might be estimated with considerable error. Finally, though, there are important concepts for which measurement can only be regarded as impossible. Sometimes this is because they're complete abstractions, where measurement depends entirely on an assertion that some observable thing is really the abstract thing. Think of things like social capital, ease of doing business, or animal spirits. What are they, and how would you know if they are changing? Other impossible concepts include qualities of people's preferences or beliefs that they can't reasonably be expected to elucidate. These include time preference, risk preference, and elasticities of substitution. I mean, really, if a pollster called you tonight and asked you about your rate of time preference or the curvature of your utility function, could you tell them? I'm guessing not. Now, maybe you could elicit somebody's time preference or risk appetite indirectly by watching people's behaviour as circumstances changed. This is what we mean by revealed preference, but it's not something you can learn from them by asking. And I believe this feature distinguishes these concepts from the inferable ones that I already mentioned. If something is not fully observable, this has many implications for its role in public policy making. This is true for any policy realm, whether it be health, education, defence, macroeconomic management, or anything else. I suspect that many of these implications are underappreciated. And in this talk, I'm going to go through seven implications that occur to me about these issues of invisibility. Firstly, the less visible something is, the harder it is to use as an objective of policy. Now, most people would be familiar with the adage, originally a quote from Peter Drucker, that what gets measured gets managed. Others frame the idea as you become what you measure. There's a whole industry of KPI design and dashboard creation that's grown up to serve industry and government's needs to define objectives and hold people accountable for meeting them. But some things are harder to measure. And indeed, the negative version of the statement, you can't manage what you can't measure, is almost as popular as the positive framing. Now, it's easy to measure a firm's leadership on meeting quantitative objectives such as sales or profits or staff turnover. It is much harder to measure many qualities that might matter more, like those leaders' judgment, ability to manage a crisis, or inspire and engage staff. So it is with public policy. Concrete, measurable metrics are much, much easier than abstractions. And this is also true for the people charged with achieving the objectives as well as those holding them accountable. It is far easier to know if you are succeeding at a goal of reducing maternal mortality than a goal to foster social harmony, or indeed preserve financial stability. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try to achieve those more abstract goals, but it does make it harder to know if you are on the right track. And you might need to be a bit humbler about what is achievable. Second, if objectives must be measured, not directly observed, some judgment is needed. If an objective is measurable but not directly observable, things are easier than if the objection must be inferred, let alone if it is a complete abstraction like social harmony or confidence. But the way these observables are measured is still a matter for judgment. Now take the case of inflation, for example, where this is defined as the rate of change in the prices of goods and services that households buy. Now to measure this, many different prices, directly observable, must be collected and combined into an index. A number of decisions need to be made. These include what prices to put in that index, how these prices should be collected, how they should be combined, and over what time period their rate of increase should be calculated. There are principles of good statistical practice that apply here, of course, such as whether a particular approach yields an index that is representative, or robust, or verifiable. Other decisions will be shaped by what is feasible with current technology and resources. As more goods and services are sold online and not in stores, it becomes less costly to collect those prices. Supermarket scanners capture both price and quantity of goods sold at a highly granular level. This makes it easier for statistical agencies to combine prices according to current spending patterns rather than older patterns that might no longer be representative. Indeed, it is one of the developments that has helped reduce substitution bias in the Consumer Price Index, giving the bank and other stakeholders a more accurate view of current inflation pressures. This has complemented the improvement in this area coming from the Australian Bureau of Statistics' recent shift to updating the weights in the CPI more frequently than in the past. Sometimes, though, there's more than one right answer. For example, when measuring consumer price inflation, statistical agencies exclude asset prices such as existing homes because purchases of these are generally transfers between households. But there is a genuine choice to be made about whether to measure housing costs by imputing a rental payment for all households, as is done for the US measure of the CPI, or to do so using an acquisition method to capture the cost of newly built homes, as is the case in Australia's CPI. Thirdly, and relatedly, measurement of objectives involves social license. Because of the need for judgment in measurement, the use of a measurable objective becomes a social process. The credibility of that objective is a form of social license. This kind of social license affects both the compiler of that measurement and those held accountable for achieving it. Often we hear claims that the cost of living is rising much faster than the actual inflation figures would imply. Now, part of this is a salience issue. There is a long-standing literature showing that people are more likely to notice inflation in the prices of things they buy frequently, like groceries, than in things they purchase rarely, like cars, appliances, or newly built homes. And they notice certain prices, like petrol, more than the multiple prices of other things that add up to the same share of their budget, like pet food. People also tend to notice the big increases in a few prices more than they notice the smaller increases or even declines in many other prices. It's also the case that the price people pay isn't necessarily the way the price is recorded in official statistics. This can lead to misperceptions of the current inflation rate. In particular, if a firm starts selling a higher quality good at the same price, to the extent that quality can be measured, this is recorded as a fall in prices. The faster computer, the car with more features, the project home with better appliances, these are all examples of this issue. But people won't necessarily perceive this as a fall in price. The price they actually pay is the same. They're just getting more for it. Now, these issues are all challenges for inflation measurement, but they're also issues of challenge. They're also challenges for communication for central banks. To meet this challenge, the best response is transparency. The inflation measure that the bank is mandated to target is not, strictly speaking, a measure of the cost of living, but it is close to it. In practice, the measures of increase in the cost of living are very similar to CPI inflation. And that similarity is really important for social license. If we're going to be mandated to target something as a central bank, that target should be relevant to the welfare of the people of Australia. So it is important for inflation targeting central banks to be transparent about the nature of that target, how it relates to the prices people see in their daily lives, and how we interpret the various forces affecting inflation and the cost of living over time. Furthermore, it is important to be able to communicate those messages in a range of forums. A fourth observation: inferring the value of an invisible quantity amounts to assuming that a particular theory is true. When we move from the observables, like CPI inflation, to the inferables, like the NAIRU, even more issues arise. One is that inferring some invisible quantity from the behaviour of some more visible one amounts to an assertion that these things are related in a particular way. You are, in essence, asserting that a particular theory or a particular model of how the world works is true. Now, in the case of the NAIRU, at least, that assertion is based on reasonably solid grounds. The exact relationship might change over time and the uncertainty of measurement might complicate things. But across many countries and many decades, there is a level of unemployment below which wages growth starts to pick up meaningfully. You can see when an economy has reached that point. And that is all the NAIRU is, the label we give to that point. The strength here is that the definition of the NAIRU is framed in terms of things that are more visible and measurable: actual unemployment and actual wages growth and inflation. For other concepts such as risk appetite or uncertainty, the connection to measurable quantities is far more nebulous, and that is partly because the theory in these areas is less settled. A fifth observation: that many inferable quantities are emergent properties of the system. And taking the example of the NAIRU again, we should note that its precise value is not a number handed down from the heavens. It is an outcome. It is the result of individual decisions of a large number of workers and firms. Those decisions do not depend on people knowing the current level of the NAIRU. They don't even have to know that the NAIRU is a thing that exists, at least in theory. Rather, people make decisions about the level and the rate of change in wages to offer, and those decisions are presumed to relate in some systematic way to the state of the labour market. It really helps to think about the economics here, and specifically about the human behaviour aspect, because economics is, in the end, all about human behaviour. Think about what is happening when a firm decides to offer a larger wage increase than before, or when workers successfully demand one. A firm might decide to offer higher wages if they can't find a suitable candidate at the current wage. It's easy to see why that decision might depend on the overall level of unemployment, because the unemployed represent an important part, though not the entirety, of the pool of potential candidates. That said, it's also easy to see why it might depend on other things. That decision might depend on other things as well. For example, it could depend on how well the skills of the candidate pool match the requirements of the job on offer, and on how easy it is to find those candidates. What this means is that the level of the Nauru is an emergent property of the system. It is not baked in. It can change. And in a number of advanced economies, it has indeed changed. The unemployment rate has reached multi-decade lows in several economies. Wages growth has been picking up for a while, suggesting that the unemployment rates in these countries are now below whatever their Nauru is. But they also reached much lower levels of unemployment before this happened than they would have expected based on historical estimates of the Nauru. Accordingly, official estimates of these countries' Naurus have indeed declined. A sixth observation. Invisible quantities relating to subjective beliefs or preferences are inherently harder to rely on than emergent system properties. We can't directly observe the Nauru. We don't know exactly where it is. But we can infer how far above or below we are from the behaviour of wages growth and inflation. We can't even be sure if it's a sharp line or a more gradual and amorphous transition to a different state of the labour market, but at least we know when we've crossed that threshold, as indeed some of the countries on this graph have done. It is much harder to rely on our estimates of a subjective belief or preferences, such as inflation expectations. How do we know if these have risen or fallen? How do we know where they sit relative to the target for inflation that the bank has been charged with achieving? Well, we can keep asking people about their expectations, but this presupposes that the measures we have are capturing the views of the people whose decisions matter for economic outcomes. It also presupposes that the people we ask are telling the truth about their beliefs. And the fact that we're asking at all presupposes that people's expectations about this outcome even matter for the decisions that they make. So it's no wonder that in economics we make much of the usefulness of revealed preferences. Observing people's actions rather than asking their opinions. You can tell me how much you think a thing is worth, but you reveal your preference when you actually pay money for that thing. And in the case of financial market pricing, you reveal your beliefs about future inflation when you are prepared to stake money on the outcome. But your beliefs could still be biased, and they might not affect actual outcomes much. So some caution is warranted here. The seventh observation, that trends are also invisible. Much of economic forecasting and analysis is all about extracting signal from noise. It's about abstracting from the temporary bumps and one-offs that pervade economic data and getting at that trend. Now, the team at the bank spends a lot of time trying to identify these one-offs. Whether it's the effect of a cyclone on iron ore exports, or the effect of petrol prices or policy changes on particular components of the CPI. Now, for inflation at least, there are established techniques for abstracting from outliers, but there's no one right choice. Assessment of where the trend lies is especially important for forecasting. Now, our assessment of trend growth in productive capacity will affect our view of how quickly spare capacity might be absorbed. Our assessments of trend growth in the population and in productivity both affect our view of trend growth in productive capacity, and so on. You can bring data to bear on these questions. In the end, though, you also have to make a call about how fast you think trends can change. And again, that is complicated because the trend is invisible and has to be inferred. Given that much of my talk has used the Nauru as an illustration of the issues surrounding invisibles, it's worth noting that another important yet invisible trend is the trend in inflation expectations, the other invisible in the Phillips curve. There are many different measures of expectations capturing different horizons of the future and the views of different groups in society. They will inevitably be both measurement noise and a variety of biases in these individual measures. It's important to cut through that noise and estimate a sensible measure of the trend. But again, both data and a judgment about the smoothness of that trend must be brought to bear on that assessment. No matter what kind of invisible something is, there are clearly times when invisible things can be consequential. The NAIRU is a perfect example of this. The bank's estimate of the level of the NAIRU is important for our assessment of the state of the economy and the appropriate stance of monetary policy. Now, the unemployment rate is currently around the lowest it's been in recent decades. Only in the mid-2000s, in the midst of the mining investment boom, was unemployment lower than the 5% rate that it reached late last year. In that previous cycle, wages growth and inflation were picking up strongly, and some parts of the economy showed signs of overheating. In contrast, wage and price pressures are low at the moment, even though unemployment is only a bit higher than it was during the mining boom. So we infer from this that there is still spare capacity in the labour market. Now, one might want to conclude that the reason wages growth has remained low is that some special factor is preventing it from increasing. And there are all sorts of factors one might want to point to, including government wages caps, changes in competitive pressures or bargaining power, or increased feelings of job insecurity. And maybe they do matter separately from the level of the NAIRU. But a more comprehensive explanation, and in my view a more plausible one, is that the NAIRU is lower than it used to be, possibly because of some of these factors. So even though unemployment is low, the unemployment gap is still positive. And this seems like a plausible explanation because, as this graph shows, we've already seen that happen elsewhere. Official estimates of the NAIRU for the other advanced economies have come down over the past decade, and so it seems reasonable to think that that could happen in Australia too. Now, the most basic way to infer the NAIRU is simply to observe actual unemployment, wages growth and inflation. If wages growth is low and not picking up much at the current unemployment rate, we infer that this rate is above wherever the NAIRU is. It must be lower than wherever we are now. We can also use statistical models to make this assessment, but in essence, these are just more sophisticated approaches to making the same comparison. The statistical model used by the bank to estimate the NAIRU assumes that the unemployment gap affects inflation and wages growth in a consistent manner over time, but the NAIRU itself is allowed to vary. Similar models are used at other advanced economy central banks. There are judgments to be made about how smoothly or how slowly you expect the NAIRU to change. There are technical decisions about exactly how you calculate the trend. But the model we use to estimate the NAIRU is broadly in line with the ones used elsewhere. Now, we last published our standard statistical model for estimating the NAIRU in 2017. We have made some technical changes to the model since then. In particular, we've allowed for the possibility that the data have become less volatile since the 1980s, and this is a known feature of macroeconomic data, and allowing for this structural change means that we can be a bit more confident about the estimate for the more recent period. We've also refined our estimates of the trend in inflation expectations to better account for some of the biases in some of the survey measures that are inputs to that estimate. But these technical changes have not driven the recent change in our assessment. The data have. As new data on unemployment, wages and inflation is received, the bank's estimates of the NAIRU can be updated. For example, if wages growth and inflation are lower than expected, a possible explanation is that the NAIRU was lower than previously thought and the unemployment gap is larger. Given the uncertainty of such an assessment, the NAIRU would typically move only gradually in response to that, but this very gradual adjustment in the NAIRU means that, you know, in short-term variation, using the change in the actual unemployment rate is a pretty good indicator of changes in your estimated unemployment gap. Larger revisions to the NAIRU estimates can occur over a number of years. Over the past 5 years, wages growth has been slower than would have been expected based on past behaviour. And so we've therefore gradually revised down the estimate of the prevailing NAIRU from 5.25% a few years ago to about 4.5% now. Now, there is substantial uncertainty about this estimate. There's uncertainty around the estimate of the NAIRU, even when assuming this model of the relationship between wages, inflation and the unemployment gap is the best model. We're assuming our model's true, but there's uncertainty about that. This is because even with the best choice of a statistical approach, it is still difficult to be precise about the relationship. And that's why we have error bands or uncertainty bands around it. The model estimates that there's a two-thirds chance that the current NAIRU is between 4 and 5%, and a 95% chance that it's between 3.5% and 5.5%. But given where we are in seeing what we're seeing in the data, right now we feel a bit more comfortable about being a bit more specific than that. A second source of uncertainty around our current estimate is the uncertainty around whether the model has been specified correctly. The main choice here is the economic variables that you put in it to explain that to be explained by the unemployment gap and the ways the unemployment gap affects those variables. So, for instance, the model assumes that the unemployment gap affects unit labour cost growth and unemployment, or allows it to affect them in a non-linear way. The inflationary, in our model, the inflationary effects of an unemployment rate below the NAIRU are larger than the disinflationary effects when the unemployment rate is above the NAIRU, and that's sort of what the data wants, and we allow for that. And a third source of uncertainty, as I've already mentioned, is that one of the inputs into this exercise, inflation expectations, are also unobservable. And the more uncertain our assessment of inflation expectations, the less confident we can be in our assessment of the NAIRU. The more sensitive we think inflation expectations are to recent inflation outcomes, the less the NAIRU would move. Put another way, if we thought the recent period of low inflation had resulted in expectations of inflation becoming de-anchored, we would conclude that the NAIRU was higher than we currently think. A fourth source of uncertainty is that we are necessarily estimating the NAIRU on the presumption that it moves fairly slowly. And as a consequence, as new data come in, it doesn't just change our estimate of the latest value for the NAIRU. It can also affect the recent past. And this endpoint problem means that our prior estimates will be revised. A year or so ago, we were saying that we thought the NAIRU was around 5%. I mean, the point estimate was rounding to 5. Given the uncertainties in estimation, it is probably best to talk in round numbers. So that's what we did. But with the benefit of the incoming data, not only has the estimate for the current value of the NAIRU changed, but so has that for the recent past. This sensitivity to the past of the past to subsequent data is called the endpoint problem. And it's a generic problem with many kinds of trend extraction procedures. And it's a reason to be cautious about overinterpreting the latest estimate. Now, the NAIRU, as you can see, is estimated to have declined. In fact, this graph shows it better. The NAIRU is estimated to have declined over the past 40 years. The simple observation of the data also supports this conclusion. But our usual methods for estimating the NAIRU don't tell us why that happened. They're statistical methods, so they're simply not designed to explain those changes in the NAIRU, only to identify them. We must instead seek to understand the causes by using other information about the labour market. And one thing we can look at is the composition of unemployment. One way to think about this question is to think about the NAIRU as capturing the types of unemployment that would remain even when there's no spare capacity in the labour market at the current wage rate and inflation is sustainably at target. So, for example, there'd still be some frictional unemployment. There will always be people who are between jobs for a short period of time. The short-term unemployment rate, which is the share of the labour force who've been unemployed for less than 4 weeks or 4 weeks or less, should be a good proxy for this. And short-term unemployment, which is the green line here, has declined slowly since the mid-80s, not by much. This suggests that frictional unemployment may have declined and the labour market has become a bit more efficient at matching workers and jobs. Yeah, it isn't hard to imagine that the shift to online job advertising has had something to do with this. So that's one reason why the NAIRU might be lower nowadays. The textbooks also talk about structural unemployment as being part of the NAIRU, and these are the people who, for a variety of reasons, can't find any job at the prevailing wage rates. Now, this might be, according to the textbooks, that they lack appropriate skills, or they have caring responsibilities, disabilities, or other circumstances that make it hard to find a suitable position. And the long-term unemployment rate is a good proxy for this concept. But again, it's an invisible concept, and this is a proxy. People who've been unemployed for more than a year are much less likely to find a job and to keep it than people whose unemployment spell is much shorter. That's what we see in the data. And here too, we see evidence supporting the idea that the NAIRU has fallen. Long-term unemployment has also declined substantially since the early 1990s. It increased a bit around the end of the mining investment boom. More recently, though, it has fallen a little bit principally for those who've been unemployed for between 1 and 2 years. However, the share of the labour force who've been unemployed for 2 years or more has not declined in the same way. Now, finding explanations for the decline in 1 to 2 year unemployment is a bit less straightforward than for the short-term variety. It might be that increasing flexibility in job design makes it easier for some people to combine work with caring responsibilities and for firms to accommodate workers with disabilities. But perhaps more importantly, it might well be that when labour markets are tight, firms just start seeing people as more employable. The labour market literature is full of discussions of the problem of hysteresis, or path dependence, where the scarring experience of unemployment damages people's future employment prospects. In this way, higher unemployment begets a higher NIRU. In my observation, this process can also go the other way. When labour markets tighten progressively, previously long-term unemployed people might be given a go. This helps them build up skills and experience that improves their future employment prospects. Policies to reduce barriers to employment might help here. But probably the single most effective policy would be to run the labour market a bit tighter so that there are more jobs to be filled. Could we look back in a few years and realise that the NIRU is even lower than we thought today? Look, there's no way to know for sure until we get there, but I can't rule it out. And if that turns out to be true, that would be an excellent outcome. It would mean that more people are in jobs. It would probably mean that the long-term unemployment rate has fallen further. And both of these factors would mean that fewer people were facing the kinds of disadvantage and economic exclusion that long-term unemployment can involve. I'd like to conclude by drawing two main lessons from this journey amongst the invisibles. First, many things that society takes to be important are in some sense invisible. They might be valued in their own right, like financial stability or social harmony. Or, like the NIRU, they might be something important to our understanding of how the world works and how we can achieve our goals. Their invisibility makes it harder to conduct policy and to know if we're on the right track, but it doesn't make it impossible. So we should still try. Second, and more specific to our monetary policy mandate, as the data have unfolded, it has become apparent that the unemployment rate that Australia can feasibly sustain is lower than it has been in at least the past 40 years. And that's great news. Along with low and stable inflation, one of the bank's mandates is full employment. And if it turns out that full employment is even fuller than we thought, getting there would be a real contribution to our third mandate, the economic prosperity and welfare of the people of Australia. The level of unemployment consistent with full employment might be an invisible, but it is a crucial. If Australia truly can have lower unemployment sustainably, policy should be used to try to get there. And as the Governor explained last week, that was one important consideration motivating the board's recent decision to lower the cash rate. Thank you for your time.
Okay, well, thank you, Lucy. I'm Roger Wilkins, Deputy Director of the Melbourne Institute. I'd like to thank Lucy for a very stimulating discussion and for demystifying just what these invisibles are and more importantly, how we can possibly still watch them even though they are invisible. So we have some time for questions from the audience.
Thank you, Lucy. That was very informative. I see that NIRU is basically estimated on expectations and employment rates are obviously an actual.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about the level of inequality that's growing within the economy. Obviously, since the trickle-down effect we've discovered hasn't worked, inequality has grown. As a result of that, are we seeing that NIRU is falling because people's expectations are falling because the rate of inequality is growing and henceforth they're willing to accept a job at any price as opposed to a job they really want?
Thanks for the question. It's an important issue, and the distributional effects of any policy, whether monetary policy or any other policy, are important and important considerations for policymakers to take into account. That said, the level of inequality is in some sense a choice variable, because if you look at sort of Gini coefficients or any other distributional sort of metric, there is no relationship between the pre-tax and transfer Gini coefficients across countries and the post-tax. So while, you know, it is possible that, you know, concern, as I mentioned in the talk, concerns about job security could be part of the story. I mean, you know, one of the things that I find quite extraordinary, and, you know, this is one of those, you know, little known facts, actually job tenure, job turnover, job to job has actually come down. There are fewer people losing their jobs involuntarily than at any time in recent decades. People stay in their jobs for longer. Now, that might be because they're sort of falsely, they have a false belief that their jobs are at risk, but the actual evidence around job turnover says something different. And again, this is where, you know, coming down to what's observable versus, you know, what's an abstract concept. But yeah, the level of inequality in Australia has not increased. There's a really good assessment of the evidence by the Productivity Commission, and it's been a while since I read it, so I'm not going to be able to cite the exact conclusions. But I think, again, it's important to be cautious about the sort of an assertion that, you know, inequality has exploded in this country, because a lot of that is really a story about what the tax and transfer system are doing.
Hello, Lucy. Two quick questions in relation probably to data. How do you factor in underemployment? And secondly, you talked about improvements over time for something like education. How is that factored in? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, this is where I fess up that there has been a clear demarcation about who's going to talk about what. The governor is giving a speech about spare capacity in the labour market next week. So I'm talking about the NAIRU, and he gets to talk about underemployment, and I'm not going to steal his thunder. So if I can, you know, we do think about it, and more detail will be revealed next week in the governor's speech. In terms of the education level, I mean, I think there is there was a really good bulletin article we did not so long ago where we talked about the youth labour market, and there is this question about whether people are kind of, you know, overqualified for the jobs they're doing. There may be some evidence of that. We are, but, you know, certainly, I mean, education levels have increased a lot in a trend sense over many decades. But where I think you'd see that is more in the productivity statistics rather than in the NAIRU itself. I'm not sure. It's worth thinking about, but I'm not 100% sure what the causal mechanism would be from the increase in educational attainment versus, you know, if anything, I think that would probably make people better matches. So, yeah, I mean, maybe it would reduce the NAIRU in the sense that as people's education, average educational attainment increases, that means that more people are better job matches for the jobs of today. But, more research would definitely be needed about that.
So you're not prepared to speculate on whether rising part-time employment in the economy, which creates greater scope for, I guess, underemployment, might be a factor in lowering the NAIRU?
Again, I don't want to steal the governor's thunder, but the reality is, yes, Australia has a very high rate of part-time employment. A lot of those are students. We have a very high rate of employment contiguous with full-time study. 4 out of 5 people working part-time are satisfied with their hours. This is actually these numbers are in the labour force survey, so we actually do have a fair bit of information about that. So, yeah, the rate of underemployment is basically directly proportional to the share of part-time employment. It hasn't increased that much as a share of part-time employment. And, yeah, 4 out of 5 people who are working part-time do so because that's what they want to do, because they have caring responsibilities, because they're combining it with full-time study or some other commitment. So I think it's really important to get away from this idea that part-time jobs are bad jobs. We've got this real mentality that the only, you know, only worthwhile jobs are full-time. I mean, there's also a view that part-time employment is growing, you know, massively, and there's no full-time jobs. Well, actually, over the last year, almost all of the employment growth, more than 2% of employment growth, almost all of that was full-time employment. So, you know, beware of fake news.
Lucy, thanks for that. A question that I've wondered about when thinking about the Nauru in the last couple of decades, and so I'll ask if you think about it too, and that's the effect of changing degrees of integration of the domestic and international labour market. During the resources boom, we saw a very large increase of immigration into categories of labour that were subject to very strong demand, especially the mining sector, but not only the mining sector. Now, our measures of unemployment are based on measures of domestic demand and supply of labour, but part of the potential labour force is an international one. Didn't used to be. There was a very big structural change in Australia, change in immigration policy over the past couple of decades, making it much easier for temporary employment-related, employment demand-related immigration. So I've wondered about whether this structural change in the labour market related to immigration is part of the story of a changed relationship between price pressures in the labour market and measured levels of unemployment.
Well, once someone's a resident, they'll still be counted as unemployed if they don't have a job and they're actively looking for one, regardless of whether they're a permanent resident or not. You're right that the increased sort of fungibility of particular groups of workers across borders has made a big difference, and that in terms of the ability to sort of absorb, you know, capacity from elsewhere, that is true. We do think that's changed the dynamics of the labour market. But I think the way I would frame it is that it's not just about migration. It's about, more generally, about the fact that the labour market is now more flexible. So there's a lot of work we've done about how, you know, firms are now using the hours margin rather than just sacking people when they need to vary, you know, when their labour demand varies. They're using more flexibility. And, you know, talking about the mining boom, it wasn't just about people coming from overseas. It was also the fact that we now do fly in, fly out. There were all these really creative ways to meet that demand for labour, that very strong demand for labour, which everybody knew wasn't going to be forever, in ways that didn't then, you know, result in, you know, ghost towns with, you know, people who were stuck there and didn't have jobs. So I would say it's part and parcel of the increased flexibility in the labour market more generally that we seem to be seeing in Australia. And yes, that general increased flexibility does seem to be this driver of why Australia now can have lower unemployment sustainably.
How concerned should we be about currently a zero inflation rate?
About a zero inflation rate? Well, it's positive. I mean, we're only, you know, it's one and a bit now. I mean, you know, depending on the measure you choose. So we're not that far below two. We are below two, and that is both a reason to try to meet our goals, but also one of the pieces of evidence that is entering into our assessment that the Nauru has fallen. Zero inflation is not something that we're currently seeing. That on average, the CPI is rising.
Thank you. I'm no economist, but my understanding is that a society can have as low unemployment as it wants, as long as it's willing to put up with the consequences. As evidence, you only have to travel to countries where there is no safety net, for example, welfare safety net. So it's a matter of what are you willing to put up with, what are the consequences you're willing to put up with. Your comments on that, please.
I completely agree. I mean, the Nauru is a concept we use to say that's the rate of, that's the rate of unemployment we can have without inflation getting out of hand. So you could go lower as long as you were happy with, you know, galloping inflation. And as a society, I mean, we wouldn't have the legislation, our enabling legislation wouldn't have the text it has. We wouldn't have the statement on the conduct of monetary policy that we do if society had not, as a principal, said, look, really high and variable inflation is not good for us. It actually impedes our ability to grow. It impedes our living standards. And so one of the things we want to achieve is, you know, low stable inflation. So you're absolutely right. You could go lower, as, you know, as Friedman pointed out, as long as you were willing to tolerate, among other things, ever higher inflation, or indeed, you know, some of the things you would need to get there, like, you know, perhaps changing the safety net.
Yeah, well, presumably that underpins a lot of the difference between Europe and the US in there.
I think that's the total euro area number. Let's go back to that graph. Yeah, that's the euro area number. But if you look at Germany, I mean, Germany's got an unemployment rate of 3 point something at the moment. Don't quote me on the one on the decimal place, because, you know, month to month I don't remember. But, you know, if the big figure is starting with a 3 in both the US and Germany, you know, it's this idea that Europe's, I mean, and similarly, it's also about 3.7 in the Netherlands. So there's actually a real variation. And in fact, even in Ireland, which had this enormous increase in unemployment during the crisis, it got up to sort of 15 or 20%. It's now down at 5 point something, I think. Don't quote me on that one. I am now going from memory. But yeah, actually some countries in Europe have incredibly low unemployment, and in every country you're actually seeing a trend down. Even Italy and France, where unemployment is high, it is coming off a bit. But yeah, I mean, there's only so many panels you can show in the graph, so I didn't show all the individual euro area countries. That would have been a little mosaic. But, you know, some of the big countries in Europe actually have really low unemployment rates at the moment. I think that would have been a surprise to people 10 years ago.
Thank you, Lucy, for your lucid comments and wonderful results on the Australian graph. Well done. Coming from students and friends of Milton Friedman's, he would always say that monetary policy is very powerful, but also, as you just said, delayed, and he would often use the word blunt in its effects, and not so precise, or we couldn't manage it that way. Also, things come along, like current world conditions, that could affect, particularly for Australia, its employment rate, maybe before it affects its inflation rate, which could change expectations. So the general question arising is how do you, as a monetary authority, and official here in Hong Kong, in Australia, how do you address these short-term impacts, right, to, say, employment and then employment expectations here?
Well, there are two parts here. One is, well, actually, the way we think about how the economy works is that one of the primary ways you get inflation up, for example, if it's low, is to get the labour market tighter, get wages growth rising, and, you know, get demand going so that, you know, firms raise their prices and workers get higher wages. I mean, that's, so yes, unemployment precedes inflation. That's exactly how we think the world works. But, I mean, you're also making a very valid point that there can be sort of temporary factors, and the exchange rate being one of them, that hits inflation before we can, in some sense. And that's why you have an on-average target. That's why we are not mandated to promise that inflation will always, every year, be between 2 and 3%. Why, you know, ever since inflation targeting was adopted in Australia in the 90s, it's always been framed as sort of an average over a longer period, because we think that's what can realistically be delivered. Certainly in a country like Australia, where you have these enormous terms of trade swings, these very big changes in the exchange rate, those are going to affect prices in the Australian economy before we can. So that's why you have to kind of take an average.
And what I'm thinking of also is the current trade dispute and how that could affect Australia employment very quickly in a short run, even before it might affect inflation. Yeah.
Well, specifically, it could affect growth. Now, it is fair to say that Australia has probably been less affected by the global trade disputes than many other economies. But in the end, it comes down to the risk that we have already publicly identified, that the trade disputes that are proceeding at the moment could harm global growth. That would then matter for our terms of trade, for the demand for our, the things we export. It's fair to say that a lot of the things we export are much more leveraged to domestic demand in China, more so than kind of global trade. And so it is plausible that we may be less affected by that than some other countries, but we have identified this for quite some time now as the trade disputes are a material risk to global growth, and we think it's really important to have a you know, rules-based trade system, and we, you know, we are very concerned about that as something that could happen. Noting, of course, that the exchange rate is an important automatic stabiliser when shocks from abroad happen.
Okay, well, we are out of time, unfortunately. So thank you for your questions. And can you... I've just got a small token of the faculty's appreciation.
Thank you.
You'll join me in thanking Lucy for the lecture tonight.